From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition 374 for November the 6th, 2011. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And as always, I encourage you to call in early so that we can cover all the nuances to the questions that you're asking. I like to provide a complete answer. Sometimes it may seem like I go on long and people get frustrated because they've been waiting quite a bit of time. But when I do get to your question as well, I will give it exactly the same consideration. And it's important to have as much information as possible, especially evidence-based information, right? You don't want to have someone just saying, and I include myself in this, don't take my word for it if I'm giving you my opinion, professional or otherwise. Always ask for evidence to support the comment. It's not enough just to have an expert that you hear in the media, different radio stations, television stations, espousing various views and opinions. They may be very right, and a lot of times they are in terms of what they're talking about, but it's still very important to always question. And if you have someone that becomes very defensive or hostile, and this goes for when speaking to healthcare providers or just calling up and asking a question, if you get that kind of response where someone is getting openly hostile, then you have to question, why is it they're acting that way? Just cite the evidence, let the chips fall where they are, and use that as a means of discussion, as opposed to holding fast to firmly held beliefs or biases, but rather recognizing that science in and of itself changes. The knowledge changes. We always question. We always ask, you know, what makes this true? What doesn't make this true? In as much as we're able to do so. And so that's what I'm trying to get across on the show. And also it brings me to a article written by, again, I go back to Dr. Ben Goldacre at the Guardian newspaper, author of the book Bad Science. He is actually taking off about 6 months from writing his columns because he's completing a book on the pharmaceutical industry. And he wrote in his column, and I'm going to read snippets of it because I think it's very important and apropos to what we're talking about, especially on this show. And it'll be the last I'll read some stuff of his for a while since he'll be on sabbatical. But I thought it would be important because it does summarize what he has learned. And this is what his article is about, what he has learned in the 8 years that he has written his column. And so I'm just going to read a bit of it for you. And as I said, it really brings to the fore exactly what we're trying to do on this show as well. So he writes, alternative therapists don't kill many people, but they do make a great teaching tool for the basics of evidence-based medicine because their efforts to distort science are so extreme. When they pervert the activities of people who should know better, medicine's regulators or universities, it throws sharp relief onto the role of science and evidence in culture. Characters from this community who wonder why people keep writing about them should look at their libel cases and their awesomely bad behavior under fire. You're a comedy factory. Don't go changing. Next, the real story of how the world works is much weirder than anything a quack can make up. The placebo effect is maddening, the nocebo effect more so, but the research on how we make decisions and are misled by heuristics and mental shortcuts is the wildest of all. Knowing about these belief hacks gives you thrills and power. Pharmaceutical companies can behave dismally. Most important, they still won't publish all the results of all the clinical trials conducted on humans. This is indefensible. And because we tolerate it, we don't know the true effect sizes of the medicines that we give. This absurd situation mocks the whole of medicine. We need legislation to fix it and popular movements to drive that. I'll join yours. Journalists can mislead the public about the answers of evidence-based medicine, which is bad. But they also mislead us on the methods and techniques. We live in a new era of doctors and patients, at our best, making decisions together. For that collaboration to work, everyone needs to understand how we know if something is good for us or bad for us. The basics of evidence-based medicine, of trials, meta-analyses, cohort studies, and the like, should be taught in schools and waiting rooms. It's interesting, but it's also life and death. People care about it. Politicians misuse evidence and distort it to shameful degrees. But more than that, there are endless cases of where we could do randomized trials on policies, old and new, to find out if they achieve the outcomes they're aiming for. There is no honorable excuse for failing to use the fairest tests we can design. Real scientists can behave as badly as anyone else. Science isn't about authority or white coats. It's about following a method. That method is built on core principles, precision and transparency, being clear about your methods, being honest about your results, and drawing a clear line between the results, on the one hand, and your judgment calls about how those results support hypothesis. Anyone blurring these lines is iffy. Conflict of interest stories, where someone has a vested interest in the results of their study, are important because they tell you when there's a risk that something's wrong in a piece of science. But this is only motive, the gruesome, fascinating mechanism of a crime against science, the methodological flaws, that's where the action is. People who don't really understand science can only critique it in terms of motive. Let them have that, we'll do the details. Last, nerds are more powerful than we know. Changing mainstream media will be hard, but you can help create parallel options. More academics should blog, post videos, post audio, post lectures, offer articles and more. You'll enjoy it. I've had threats and blackmail, abuse, smears, and formal complaints with forged documentation. But it's worth it, for one simple reason. Pulling bad science apart is the best teaching gimmick I know for explaining how good science works. I'm not a policeman, and I've never set out to produce a long list of what's right and what's wrong. For me, things have to be interestingly wrong, and the methods are all that matter. That to me really summarizes exactly what I'm trying to emulate on this show, and I hope you take that to heart. I know I tend to harp on this quite a bit and talk about this a lot, but this is only one show amongst the billions of dollars that is spent, millions and literally billions of dollars that is spent by media to promote other shows that really don't focus on evidence, that tend to create fear and tend to promote all kinds of wacky schemes and wacky treatments and promote a particular product, getting people to on the air to talk about their product as a means of, on the basis of a scientific study, as opposed to promoting their product, which we hear all the time. So I'm going to keep shouting this out because there aren't a lot of us who are trying to do this. And I think it is important because it does give you power as opposed to letting others telling you what to do. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go right to the phone lines as our lines are almost full, and thank you for that. Good afternoon to Kelly in Ottawa.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
I'm great. It's nice to speak with you.
Likewise.
I'm calling you today about a back issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll start with some background information.
Sure.
I do have a physiatrist.
Okay.
And it's just, I would like your expert opinion. And not having the best relationship with him and the fact that I'm not getting maybe a physical exam when I go. And so I'm calling you today about a lump that's starting on my spine.
Okay.
And from eyeballing it, it looks maybe about from C4, C5 into the thoracic.
Okay.
So I'm wondering what you think about that, given that I do have facet joint problems.
Mm-hmm.
I do get injections for that.
Okay.
They seem to help there. And I do have MRI evidence of, you know, disc degeneration and bulging, but
right.
From what I've seen there, that seems pretty much wear and tear and somewhat normal.
Exactly.
So I was wondering what you could tell me about this lump that's forming and what you could recommend.
Okay, so the lump itself, is it right over the spine? Is it beside it?
It's sticking? Right over it.
Okay, and it's sticking out of the skin. If you were to look at your back, you could see this lump sitting there.
Yes.
Okay. Now, and it's not confused with the bulge that you normally would see from C7, which is the seventh cervical vertebrae, where you have the spine that sticks out and something's going to give a little bump on the back of the neck.
Yeah, no, it seems to be getting more pronounced.
Okay. So if we were to say 3 to 6 months ago, this was not there.
Exactly.
Okay. So if there's a change that you've noted where there's a lump, it may or may not have to do anything with back pain at all. It can be something completely different. But if you're
okay.
noticing something that's growing and changing, frankly, a lump is a lump in terms of how you approach it. And so in this case, if there's something that's getting larger, that's in this case, it's on the spine, it has to be figured out what's actually growing there, especially if you're noticing that it is progressing and getting larger.
And the stiffness and the pain and sort of it's starting to lose a little bit of rotation
well,
in the neck.
Well, exactly, because if you're having something that is, you know, it can be a benign lump for, you know, as anything else. But
mm-hmm.
the fact is that if you have something that is overlying a joint space or overlying
okay.
where joints move, it can restrict that motion as well just from occupying the space.
Okay.
So I would say that although you have a physiatrist, it's probably important to head back to your family doctor, show this particular lump, get the imaging if necessary to evaluate it,
okay.
and then be made. And then on the basis of those results, because imaging, if the lump is there, it's going to tell us what it is, right? So it usually
okay.
means either doing, you can do an ultrasound, which is one of the ways to look and see if it's cystic or if it's solid. Another
okay.
another thing that can be done, which takes longer, obviously, is other imaging studies like CT or MRI. But really, a lump that's there, especially
mm-hmm.
if it's on the surface, there are many ways, instead of waiting months and months for those imaging studies, which may not tell us more than doing an ultrasound or even a biopsy of the lump, because it'll tell you what's going on in the tissue. But
okay.
those are the first things that I would do, again, based on the information you're providing, where you're saying, you know, 6 months ago there was nothing. Now there's a lump. It's painful. It's restricting motion, and it is getting larger. That needs to be looked at more than just a musculoskeletal condition. It has to be looked at as something that is could be potentially growing just under the skin. Most common things that do that are lipomas. They're sort of soft,
okay.
fleshy things. They can get larger. They're essentially benign fat growths. And
okay.
and they can be removed very easily. General surgeons remove those easily. But they can cause, they stretch the skin, they can cause pain depending on, again, where they are. If you have something that's overlying on top of a bony surface, it would tend to be more restrictive than if it was in a fleshy area of the body, you know, say on a buttock or something like that, where there's a lot
mm-hmm.
more area for a lipoma to enlarge, and it doesn't really push on very many structures. It's just,
okay.
so
okay.
it really is dependent on the anatomy and the location. But I would say to you, if you're noticing this, it's hurting, it's
okay.
causing you concern, it's not a overly involved workup in order to determine what it is.
Okay, great. I don't have a family doctor, so I wanted to get some information from you before
sure.
that.
Okay.
And given the fact that the painkillers do not affect that, it doesn't really help that, I'm actually on something called Tramadol.
Yep.
Which I wanted your opinion on,
mm-hmm.
on also.
Sure.
I know it's not a scheduled drug, so I'm wondering why it sort of seems to get treated like that
in
terms of the attitude of the physician.
Yeah, because Tramadol, usually they even have samples of Tramadol. It's not a controlled substance, although it's considered to be an opiate medication. It
yeah.
doesn't bind to the same receptors that,
okay.
that for example, morphine would or hydromorphone or Dilaudid or Percocets
yeah.
or any of those. So it doesn't have that same potential to cause addiction. That is,
okay. there's
not the same kind of withdrawal effect when you use it. It's not that
yeah.
kind of medication. So I don't know why you're getting that attitude.
Okay.
In fact, it's one of those that's recommended to be used you know, along with other pain medications like anti-inflammatories and other medications, before you even get to using narcotics, the ones that we usually associate, which is codeine, which I really don't like at all,
or
hydrocodone or any
that.
Of those things. So it's I don't know why you're getting that attitude, but it's not one of those medications in terms of tramadol that you look at someone saying, well, I'm here to get a tramadol renewal. You know, it's not something I would say, oh, you know, wow, you're using a lot of this stuff. I'd rather, what I would usually say, if you are using a lot is, okay, obviously your pain is not being very well controlled. What things are you trying? And let's look and see about a broader range of trying to treat this as opposed to depending on one medication to control pain.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Kelly.
I very much appreciate talking to you. Thank you, Dr. Dorton.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to go to line 5, and good afternoon to Alice in Ottawa.
Yes, doctor.
Hi.
Hi, sir. I have the shingle. Mm-hmm. I have the shingle about 5 months ago.
Okay.
And it's all gone away. But I'm having this terrible pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't stop at all.
Now, where on your body did you have the shingles?
Well, from the right breast, from the stomach,
mm-hmm.
lead right under the arm to the back.
And have you been using anything for the pain? Has anybody tried to...
The doctor gave me pain pill, but it doesn't help at all.
Which medication did they give you, or what medication did they provide to you?
He gave me a medication called let me spell it. It's RALLVIA.
So Relivia.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So Relivia is, interestingly, is a long-acting version of tramadol, which we were speaking to our previous caller about for pain relief. However, what you are experiencing is one of the unfortunate consequences of shingles. And the condition, the pain that you have after a shingles infection, the term for that is called post-herpetic neuralgia. Post meaning after. Mm-hmm. Herpetic refers to the fact that it's a herpes-type virus. That's what it's herpes zoster. And neuralgia means nerve pain. So it's pain after a herpes virus infection that caused shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And using tramadol is, although may be helpful, it's certainly not the drug of choice to use to try and treat post-herpetic neuralgia. In fact, there are a few medications that can help.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, one of them is not covered by the Ontario government's drug benefit plan. That one is called Lyrica or pregabalin, and that it tends to be used to treat post-herpetic neuralgia. There is another one that can be used called gabapentin or Neurontin that is covered, and that can be prescribed, has to be prescribed gradually over time. Both those medications, I tend to use the Lyrica because there is a specific indication for its use for post-herpetic neuralgia, but sometimes you have to use combinations of various medications in order to help alleviate the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that might be helpful are topical analgesics, that is, things that will numb the nerves. And there's xylocaine gel, which is a medication that is used as an anesthetic that will numb the skin surface.
Mm-hmm.
That might be helpful. But ultimately, this should be dealt with when you see your physician to say, look, the Relivia or the tramadol, the long-acting tramadol, is not helping. You've had 5 months of this pain. You shouldn't have to suffer 5 months with post-herpetic neuralgia without having different treatments tried to see if it helps alleviate your pain. So there are many solutions for this. It's just a matter of having a discussion with your physician to say, look, I need you to develop a treatment plan with me to control this pain a bit better and to use medications that are specifically designed to treat the post-herpetic neuralgia.
And he also gave me morphine.
Yeah, again, those medications, the morphine itself, these aren't what I would use first line to treat postherpetic neuralgia. I would use, like I said, you could use Lyrica and Tylenol together. You could also add a little bit more of a pain reliever in with that. But using narcotic medications alone and trying to treat postherpetic neuralgia doesn't usually help too much. Mm-hmm. So what I would say, Alice, is you have to speak to your physician and say these aren't working and you'd like to try a different type of medication specifically designed to treat this condition. Mm-hmm. We have to take a break now, Alice, but I hope that's helpful for you.
Okay.
All the best
to you.
Thank
you very much, doctor.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for the news and come back with your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go right back to the phone lines and speak to Janine in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having the opportunity to speak to you.
Sure.
6 years ago, I had a heart attack and I had a stent put in my right artery.
Okay.
A month ago, I slipped on the ice at the curling club and I fell on the backboards. And, you know, it's like a step.
Mm-hmm.
And my back, like around my shoulder blades, right across. It took the wind out of me. They took me to the hospital. I was very fortunate. I had nothing broken.
Okay.
But I've had like trauma to my body like you wouldn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that's been bugging me, particularly this last week, I went back to curling last Friday, and since then I've been feeling sort of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is it possible that that stent moved or was dislodged when I fell?
It's a good question. The what's important to keep in mind is where that stent is located and the construction of the stent. The stent itself is literally a cage that opens up and puts pressure against the arterial wall in order to keep it open.
Yeah.
So because it was inserted 6 years ago, there are all sorts of cells that have covered the surface of it that are also acting like a glue to hold it in place.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right. So any blunt trauma that you experienced is, unless that trauma was so focused on that small area of the heart, which already has protection around it from just where it's located in the body, it's very unlikely that you would have ruptured or disrupted that stent.
Okay.
And there would be symptoms to consider as well. If the stent was ruptured, you would likely be experiencing a lot of cardiac pain again because it would likely cause an obstruction.
Okay.
Right? The stent, if a stent moves, it essentially means that it's collapsed. And if it collapses, you then have something that's now acting like a plug instead of a tunnel that's kept things open. So it's unlikely that it has been disrupted.
Okay.
My question to you, though, is given your history, are you being followed on a regular basis anyway to check your heart and the stent and heart function?
Actually, I haven't been followed at all because I can't take any medication. I'm allergic to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been just taking the baby aspirin, and I've been fine.
Okay.
My blood pressure has been fine, no cholesterol. Mm-hmm. My family doctor has been monitoring me every 6 months.
Okay.
So there was no problem there.
Okay, so that's
but,
fine.
But since this has happened, my blood pressure seems to oscillate a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And I get, well, the hospital told me you don't have any broken bones, but you may have some broken ribs, and it doesn't show that.
Okay.
So the pain was from the back right through to the front, and it's right around, you know, like on the right side, just about where that thing was put in.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the pain is there, and sometimes it goes away. If I sit too long, if I stand too long, it reacts.
Okay.
And the pain goes right through. And I actually been feeling like the muscles sort of like they were in the spasm.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I saw that I was falling on that board, I tightened up my back so I would spare my spine.
Mm-hmm.
But my muscles took a real bruising. Now, there was no blue or anything. It's all on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I swelled for about a week and a half in the front.
So you had pretty severe trauma.
Yeah. I also had my son-in-law is a chiropractor, and I've been seeing him 3 times a week. And there was one thing that happened, like 2 mornings in a row, I got up and my head was spinning, and I lost my balance. I thought, what's going on? So the next morning, I was a little bit more careful when I got up, and he said, oh, there's something in your body that's been affected by this trauma. And he named the part, whatever it was. I don't remember now, but anyway. So after 2 days, it went away. So I'm still experiencing, I guess, side effects from this. Well, it's been a month now.
I'm not surprised, because it can take several months after an injury like that for your body to heal up completely. Okay. What you experienced when you stood up was a drop in blood pressure. It had nothing to do with any organ inside your body. Sometimes when we stand up from either a lying or sitting position to a standing position, blood pressure can temporarily drop. You can feel dizzy, feel like you're going to faint. And then within about 30 seconds to a minute, it tends to correct itself.
Okay.
And so that's, and it's now gone. So that's one less thing for you to be concerned about.
Yeah, that went away.
But I'm not surprised. I mean, you had quite severe blunt trauma. This is not a small injury. And even though you may not have fractured any ribs, the fact that you protected yourself by tightening up all the muscles in some way helps, but in other ways, it actually can make the problem worse after the injury.
Yeah.
Because then everything is tight, it's more chance for the muscles to tear, as opposed to when someone hits the surface, and if their muscles are relaxed, there's less trauma to the muscle in terms of tearing. There certainly can be more bruising, but there's less tearing. And what's happened is that you've torn muscles. It takes a while for them to heal, especially from the chest wall. It's not as if someone can say to you, okay, stop breathing for the next month so that your muscles can heal up, right? You have to keep breathing.
Yeah.
And so breathing and your upper body, the musculature of your arms, there are muscles that run on your rib cage from your arms and shoulders so that your rib cage acts as a foundation for your arms to move.
Yeah.
And so just normal activity, you know, the curling, the day-to-day activity at home, just normal activities that you do are all going to pull on areas of the chest that have been damaged.
Yeah.
The chest is going to heal, but it's the proverbial 2 steps forward, 1 step back type of thing.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah, but it will heal up. You just have to give it time, but it can take months. For the same reason, when you think about hockey players, they're on a rink as well. They get hit against the boards, and they're wearing padding, and they're wearing stuff, and they have a lot of muscle on them, and they're big guys. But, you know, they get injured, they get a chest wall injury, and they're out for 6 to 8 weeks. So,
well, I was pretty lucky because I'm 73 years old, but I have a lot of muscle, and
that's good. I think it did. But at the same time, being 73 means that you don't heal like a 25-year-old anymore.
That's true.
It does take a while. But I'm glad. But stay active.
Yeah.
You know, keep moving around. But
what I've been doing is I've been going down to the pool and doing like stretch exercises in the water.
Well, that's terrific.
And pushing water down and lifting water so that I'm using those muscles, but I'm not straining them.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea, Janine. And that's exactly what you have to do. But don't be frustrated in terms of the time it's taking. It will get better. You're doing all the stuff you're supposed to do.
Okay.
But it is just going to take your body. It has its own time that it heals up and the muscles will heal. You just have to keep moving along. But
yeah, and I guess my blood pressure will fluctuate too until that's over.
Blood pressure fluctuates if you have pain, right? Someone that's in pain, blood pressure tends to go up.
Okay.
So it will fluctuate on that basis.
Okay. I didn't realize that.
Well, just don't fall on the boards again.
I'll try not to.
All right. Well, all the best, and I hope you get better soon.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And we're going to go to line 3. And good afternoon to Mira in Ottawa.
Yeah, it's me. Hi. Hi, it's Myra.
Myra.
Okay, hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Okay, I have a question for
you.
I have osteoporosis.
Yes.
And I'm taking all the appropriate medications,
okay,
including calcium caltrate and heavy doses of vitamin D and magnesium in order to have the absorption for these calcium pills. I've spoken to several people recently who've been told by their doctors, stop taking the calcium pills. They have found out in research recently that it can cause calcification of the arteries, and you should be getting all your calcium from food. Now, I have not been told that. I have to admit, I've not been to my doctor for a while.
Right.
But I was certainly under the impression supplementing with calcium citrate was a very good idea, as long as you take the D. So I'd like to know the current thinking on that, please.
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that was one study. So from one study, and it looked at a specific group of women, and I believe these women, I'd have to be absolutely sure, but I believe they already had pre-existing heart disease. So it wasn't a matter of healthy women taking calcium. It was pre-existing heart disease. I'd have to check on that particular aspect of the methods that they used. But nevertheless, the issue of taking calcium in women who have osteoporosis, you need the calcium in order for your bones to regenerate, at least with the medications that you're taking. Which medication are you using for your osteoporosis?
Oh, I'm taking Evista.
Okay.
I'm no longer taking the Actinel because I've been on this medication for over 5 years.
Okay.
So I'm taking the Evista, and in heavy doses of calcium D and mm-hmm. magnesium.
Okay. Well, and do you have a history of heart disease?
No. My mom had problems. I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay. Cholesterol levels are good. Everything is
cholesterol a little bit high, but right. My LDL is very good. So doctors, the ratio is very, very good.
Okay. Well, what I would say is that, you know, as with anything, if you're taking, for example, 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day, which is usually what's recommended, it's the two of the 500 milligram tablets, you know, there has not been any specific recommendation that has come out to say to stop doing that. There really isn't enough evidence to tell women, especially for those who have osteoporosis, to stop doing that. And taking the vitamin D is also very helpful. What I would say, though, is that Evista is an okay medication for treating osteoporosis, but it's not the greatest. You have already taken 5 years of the, what we call the bifosphonates, which was the
yeah.
Actinel. So that's sort of the limit on that for a while. There is something else that is available that has now been out for a little bit over a year or so that works by a completely different mechanism and has had evidence to suggest that it improves bone mass quite well, you know, on the order of, you know, anywhere between 2 to 7% increase in bone mass over the course of a year. This medication is an injectable medication.
Yeah.
It's given twice a year. It's not a bifosphonate. Side effects are minimal because it targets a specific protein that essentially signals a cell in a bone cell to absorb bone. So it stops that from happening, and so your bone gets thicker. And so that's another medication other than Evista that you may want to talk about with your family doctor. The medication is called Prolia, Prolia.
Prolia, okay.
It is expensive. I mean, it's about $300 a dose, and it's two doses over the course of a year. But if you've already exhausted the use of bifosphonates, if you were my patient, I would say, okay, let's look at Prolia as opposed to Evista, because it's also easier to take. And also there's more evidence for Prolia being effective at improving bone mass than Evista would. There's nothing wrong with Evista. It's not a terrible drug. It's a second-line medication, not a first-line medication.
Okay, because I am actually on the borderline between osteoporosis and osteopenia.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not extremely bad.
Okay.
So might Prolia, not be necessary in my case?
The indications for Prolia are for women with a diagnosis of osteoporosis.
Okay.
So depending on your bone density result, usually if your average bone density is when they give the numbers minus 2.5 or less, considered
yeah.
to be osteoporosis. And then that's where the indication for use would be.
Oh, I understand that.
But with regards to the calcium, I wouldn't throw the calcium away. And, you know, as I said, studies will come and go, and you can't hang your hat on one particular study as a means of making a recommendation globally to all women.
Okay. And what would be the maximum of elemental calcium I should take by tablet?
Well, usually it's calcium carbonate that's taken, and usually go by the total calcium carbonate. So it's 500 milligrams, two of those once a day. I usually don't go by the elemental calcium. I just go by the two tablets once a day. And we're going to take a small break because we've run over a little bit. And we'll be right back. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Somehow I made it through.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And right back to the phone lines. Good afternoon to Carol in Orleans.
Yes, hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. I was diagnosed with pseudomyxoma peritonei.
Pseudomyxoma peritonei.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you know about that, or...
This is a condition that usually starts in the appendix. The appendix.
Yes, I had my appendix removed in September.
Right, and there are cells in the appendix that end up seeding other parts of the colon and also into the abdomen. These cells produce a lot of what we call almost like gelatin, like a mucus type material that can that can accumulate around the various organs, so the liver, the spleen, the other intestines. And if left untreated, this mucus material that builds up can end up squeezing some of the organs. So it can squeeze the intestine and block it off from the outside. Sort of just, it's like taking a tube and wrapping your hand around a tube and squeezing on it. That kind of effect. And these are benign. It's not a malignant tumor per se, but they are cells that are growing that produce this mucus in different pockets around the abdomen. The only treatment that they have right now, I mean, they've looked at different treatments with regards to radical surgery to remove all the deposits in the abdomen and use chemotherapy agents to kill some of the cells. But because this condition is quite rare, they usually find this condition in about 2 in 10,000 people who have open surgery in the abdomen. So it's quite rare. They don't know if that's actually helpful, and it's quite a radical procedure to do. So what they tend to recommend, and I'm not sure if this is what they've recommended to you, is it's called debulking. So they do resections of what we call the gross disease, that is the large areas. If there are large mucus-filled tumors that are in the abdomen, they'll usually do surgery to remove those to prevent it from building up and pushing on the organs. So I'm not sure if they've offered that to you or they've just given you the diagnosis and you're supposed to go back and discuss this with them. What has happened right now up to date for you?
Well, I've already had surgery at the general there.
Okay.
I had 10 liters of fluid removed from my abdomen.
Right.
And they removed my appendix.
Right.
And a part of my intestine, apparently.
Because it was really pushing in and obstructing the area.
Yeah, I guess maybe it had some disease part, maybe around the appendix also.
Right.
And I'm going to Toronto on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an appointment with Dr. McCart.
Okay.
At Mount Sinai.
And that's to look at different approaches to treat it, I would imagine.
Yes, she specializes in this disease.
Yeah, so they may offer that other solution where they use chemotherapy in the abdomen. So it's not that they put it into intravenously. The information that I have is that they put it into the abdomen itself, so there's less side effects that way as well.
Okay.
There is some absorption, but ultimately, the person you're going to see is certainly much more qualified than I am in terms of being able to provide you with solutions. But in terms of what the condition is, it is essentially a benign tumors that grow in the abdomen, produce a lot of mucus that, as you've pointed out, can really obstruct and block a lot of the organs, and it needs to be removed before it takes up so much space. And 10 liters...
I had 10 liters removed.
That's a lot of space and a lot of weight as well.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
Pressure. It was like a relief operation, eh?
Right. Well, 10 liters is about 10 kilograms. That's about 22 pounds.
That's a lot of weight. I know I lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
I came home, eh?
That's a lot of weight to have to carry around, especially. And also, it's not just the weight. It's the fact that it's... impinging on the organs in your abdomen.
Yes, and I also couldn't eat because I always felt full.
Yeah, it blocks everything up.
It blocks everything up.
Yeah.
So I don't know what she's going to have to say.
I would be interested, Carol. Once you come back from Toronto, if you can give a call and let us know, I'd be very curious to know what they've offered you.
I will do that for sure.
All right.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Carol. All the best. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye
now. And we're going to go to line five. And Anne in Gatineau, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. My mother is a very healthy 80-year-old,
yes.
And she's always been prone to headaches.
Okay.
But this past year, the headaches became constant.
Okay.
To the point that she got double vision. So she went to see the optometrist, who sent her to the ophthalmologist, who actually sent her to the eye clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was diagnosed that she might have had a small blood clot, a very small one, that was causing the pain.
Mm-hmm.
That went away, and the specialist at the time suggested that she take a baby aspirin every night,
okay,
which she's had done. And then, so she saw the specialist in mid-July. The headaches haven't really gone away. And then over the last 10 days, she increased the baby aspirin to one in the morning also.
Mm-hmm.
This past week, her earlobe was so hard and so hurting that she couldn't even sleep on that side.
Okay.
And she was wondering if that possibly could be the clot making its way through the brain path.
Unlikely. In the earlobe itself, there's no direct connection between the artery, the blood vessels that run in the earlobe and the brain itself. The connection of blood vessels that run into the brain actually come off in the neck. There's your carotid artery. It's the area where if you push your fingers against the side of your neck, you feel your heart beating. That's your carotid artery, and it divides into two arteries, the internal, which goes inside the skull, and the external carotid artery, which goes to the outside. So the earlobe isn't what's causing the headache or a clot. What I am concerned about is that she's 80 years old and she's having headaches that she's really never had before. And that's really concerning to me. And I would recommend for her, aside from the aspirin, which really I don't think is going to do too much, she needs to be evaluated completely for all causes of headache. So in other words, scanning her head, checking blood pressure, checking for clots in the carotid arteries, because I'm just not happy that an 80-year-old woman all of a sudden is having constant headaches. It's just not normal for her. And,
right.
And certainly can be a harbinger for, things you want to try and avoid are stroke, any increased pressure in the head. If they said that it may have been a clot in the eye itself, well, if there can be a clot in the eye, which is dealing with arteries that come from inside the head, then you can also get clots inside the brain as well. So I'm just not happy with the fact that she's having these clots. And what I would recommend on more of an urgent basis is for her to see her physician and to have an appropriate headache workup done. Either the physician itself can start that up or a neurologist, but she needs to be actively managed for this. It's just not good for an 80-year-old to have constant headaches this way.
Okay, so she actually got a requisition for a brain scan.
Okay.
So that's the next step to do, right?
That would be the next step, but I'm still not happy that she's having this headache. I would do the scan, but I would also check blood pressure and other things that could also contribute to her headaches. For a lot of older folks, even pressures that are, what we consider to be not so bad for someone who's younger can actually be harmful to somebody who is going to be, who's 80 years old. But anyway, and unfortunately, we're out of time, but what I would say is that you definitely have to get her urgently looked at. For a headache like that goes on all the time, not a good thing to hang on for weeks and weeks. That about wraps it up for Sunday House Call. My thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call and your calls. We've been pretty much full all the way. My apologies to Faye. We can get to your call next week. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.